No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Together with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Before we bring on our guests tonight, let me first say hello to my co-host, Maria. Maria, how are you?
I'm terrific, Michael. My final academic semester ended on Friday. I earned my master's degree in media psychology, and now it's all about the dissertation.
Well, you know, I saw this on Facebook, and I gave you a thumbs up, and I just think you're amazing, Maria.
Well, likewise, ditto.
Well, you know, this is really what people should do in life, right? I used to have a friend that used to say, those who seek to teach must never cease to learn. And so it's just amazing that you're doing this and you're always improving yourself and going for a new adventure. And I'm sure that whatever you do in media psychology, it'll be amazing. In fact, it's going to have to soon be the Maria show with Mike. I should have made you sign a prenup. I don't know.
I might just pull the picture on you now and then, since you get to get the senator now and then.
And I'm going to have to call you doctor. It's going to have to be Dr. Maria. Yep. But anyway, this week we had a few things happen with statehood. We have to shout out going to Representative Gottheimer, who is from New Jersey's 5th. He's our 218th co-sponsor. You need 218 votes to pass legislation. So it's looking pretty good for our hearing that's coming up next month. And Representative Gilbert Cisneros, you'll never guess where he's from.
Where? California.
California's 35th district. California has 44 co-sponsors on the bill. That's more than twice as many as anybody else. God bless the people of California.
That's like 20%, right?
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, let's just get everybody from California to sign on. We don't need those other people.
That's right.
That's great. Well, tonight we're going to talk about a very interesting subject, which has come up in the presidential debates. Marianne Williamson, who was one of the candidates that was on our show a few weeks ago, brought it up. And today we have one of the leading experts in America on this very subject, and that is reparations. We're lucky to have with us Dr. William Darity from Duke University. And he's going to, Professor Darity, just let me give you a little background on him. He is the Samuel Du Bois Cook Professor of Public Policy, African and African American Studies and Economics, and the director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equality at Duke University. Professor Darity has served as chair of the Department of African and American Studies and was a founding director of the Research Network on Racial and Ethnic Inequality at Duke. Previously, he served as director of the Institute of African American Research, directing the Moore Undergraduate Research Apprenticeship Program, Director of the Undergraduate Honors Program in Economics, and Director of the Graduate Studies at the University of North Carolina. Dr. Doherty, are you with us? We're so happy to have you tonight.
I'm with you, and I would like to thank you for having me on, and I'd like to add my congratulations to Ms. Sanchez as she proceeds along the road toward her doctorate.
Well, aren't you the sweetest? Thank you so much.
You know, I got to tell you, Dr. Doherty, it's hard for me to say nice things about a guy that's taught at North Carolina and Duke, because I went to the University of Maryland. And I remember many times screaming during basketball games at people that went to your schools. But
we still regret the fact that the Terrapins exited to the Big Ten. It just doesn't work for us.
I got to tell you, I said to the president of Maryland when I met him one time, what am I supposed to do about my hostility towards Duke? Am I just supposed to get rid of that? It's been a 30-year tradition for me. And, of course, during football season, we also regret that we moved to the Big Ten and haven't played Ohio State, Michigan, and schools like that. But can we start, Dr. Doherty, by you telling us exactly what you mean by reparations, paying reparations?
So I define reparations as compensation for a grievous injustice or a series of grievous injustices that have been directed against a particular community. And so as a consequence, the compensation should include some form of monetary restitution to the community that has been adversely affected by these atrocities. It is quite reasonable to design a reparations program or a program of restitution in such a way that you provide different types of uses of the funds, but I think that in every serious instance of a reparations program, some component of that program, an important component, has been direct payments to the eligible recipients.
And is that what they've done in Germany? I know in Germany, am I correct about this, that there's a program that was put in place by the German government? I think Marianne Williamson mentioned this, where they paid restitution to Jews that were German citizens. Is that correct?
It's payments primarily to folks who were Jewish, because that's the largest proportion of the victim population of the Holocaust. But technically, the reparations program is for all persons who were victimized by the Holocaust, as well as their heirs and descendants. And yes, it's been a program of monetary restitution to the victims and their heirs and descendants, and those payments are still going on to this day.
Michael? You mentioned Native Black Americans and three objectives, which I think are acknowledgement, redress, and closure. Could you go through those for us, please?
Sure. So by acknowledgement, I mean kind of a two-headed apology. One head of the apology is a recognition or admission on the part of the perpetrator that they have done a serious wrong, and also a recognition, and this is the other head of it, a recognition that that there have been those who have benefited from the atrocities that have been inflicted on a particular community. So that's what I mean by acknowledgement. It's associated with a full apology. Redress is restitution for the harms that have been committed. Typically, the types of atrocities that we're concerned about are harms or horrors that cannot be fully compensated, but certainly you can alter and improve the trajectory of the lives of the victim communities by providing them with some form of restitution. And so that's the second dimension of it. And then the third and final dimension is closure, which is and a recognition on the part of both the perpetrator and the victim that the debt has been paid, that there is no reason for the victims to make any further claims on the perpetrator unless there is a new set of atrocities.
So and the Native Black Americans, my last part of the question.
What does that mean?
So
I have been consistent in arguing that the eligible population for Black reparations in the United States should be Black Americans who are descendants of persons who were enslaved in the United States. And so that community is a community that has a particular or unique claim because these are the folks who are descendants of the formerly enslaved who, upon emancipation, were promised 40-acre land grants, but they were never given those 40-acre land grants. And that laid the foundation for the full array of economic inequalities, particularly the Black-white wealth gap that we observe today. So, so that's the community that I have indicated should be the recipient of this form of reparations or this category of reparations.
Well, you know, let's talk about that for a second, Doctor, because it seems to me that African Americans in general, if we look at their poverty rate, if we look at their incarceration rate, if we look at the gap that you mentioned between wealth and also education, African Americans in America have been discriminated against and traumatized and have gone through this, whether they're direct descendants of slaves or not. Isn't that true? Is there some way that you have to trace descendancy in order to qualify for reparations? I've got to trace my
form of the program that I've been working on trying to develop. Yes, absolutely. An individual would have to demonstrate two things. The first is they would have to demonstrate that they are a descendant of at least one person who was enslaved in the United States. And then the second thing is, for at least 10 years before the onset of the reparations program or a study commission, whichever comes first, the individual would have to demonstrate that they self-identified as Black, Negro, or African American. There is no question that more recent immigrant communities from the African continent and from the Caribbean have been subjected to discrimination and other types of harms in the United States that are related to their racial identity. But I think that they must make a separate claim. And in particular, I think the claim that they ought to make is one that should be directed against the colonial powers that either enslaved or engaged in imperialism towards their countries of origin. There is a CARICOM Commission for Reparations that organizes a set of the Caribbean countries to obtain reparations from the countries that were the imperial powers vis-a-vis them. And the CARICOM Commission's focus is exclusively on the Caribbean-based countries. So similarly, I think that in the context of the United States, the particular claim on the U.S. government is one that should be made by folks who are descendants of persons who were enslaved here.
May I say on a small level that the NFL is doing something similar to their players regarding the concussion and how they're determining what kind of compensation they can receive? And again, it's small because we're talking hundreds, not tens of thousands, if not millions of individuals. Have you checked out their program and how they ascertained what dollar value to arrive at and how that might work in harmony with what it is that you're proposing?
I don't think that there's really much of a consistency between the way in which they are approaching this and the way in which the kind of work that I've been doing with some other scholars tackles this issue. in projects like the NFL's, as well as maybe more significantly, the way in which reparations was handled for families that lost loved ones in 9/11, is that the typical procedure is to try to forecast or predict what the deceased individual's stream of future earnings would have been. And that's what's used as the basis for trying to construct the measure. That is, the future earnings if the person had not been killed, or the future earnings if the person had not been subjected to extreme head trauma, whatever the kind of harm is that's in question. But I have not thought that the way in which we should focus on an allocation of reparations for Black Americans should be based on expectations about individuals' future streams of earnings, especially because future earnings are going to be subjected to discriminatory penalties in the United States. So that just doesn't seem to be an appropriate way to do this in this context. In my work, I've tended to emphasize the notion that a reparations program should target the racial wealth gap in the United States, and it should be designed to eliminate the racial wealth gap in the United States. This means that since Black Americans currently own about 2.6% of the nation's wealth, but constitute closer to 13% of the nation's population, then a reparations program should move the Black share of wealth into at least equal proportion with the Black share in the population. So move it from 2.6% to 13%. And this would require somewhere in the vicinity of $10 to $12 trillion.
And would that would compensate all African Americans in a sense, right? What I'm thinking is that I work with Native Americans, and the way they distribute money on a reservation as compensation for similar things is twofold. Some that have casinos and other revenue generating mechanisms or organizations, they distribute directly. They just split the money up among the surviving members of the tribe. But mostly what they do is put money into programs that will help everybody in the tribe. They establish community colleges. They pay for college educations. They pay for health care, things like that. Is that what that would do for the African community rise the whole, bring the whole community up to their 13%?
I'm thinking that the program should be designed to ensure that the average Black household has the same level of net worth as the average white household. So I'm thinking more in terms of the allocative process that's associated with matching household wealth across the groups. But if there were community-based programs that would facilitate that, then I'm quite open-minded about introducing them. The difficulty that I observe with some community-based or place-based programs is that their benefits are too diffuse because, for example, if we think about something that is community or neighborhood-based, in the aftermath of waves of gentrification, you don't necessarily have the community that should be the target population living in the places that historically were Black communities. And so you have to be more precise. And so I think that greater precision is achieved by at least making a substantial portion of the reparations fund take the form of direct payments to eligible recipients.
Well, and you know, what you've just said is a real problem here in the District of Columbia. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but gentrification is one of the top issues in D.C. these days. We see a city which is more and more and more expensive to live in. We see traditional Black neighborhoods, which were actually some of the first middle and upper middle class black neighborhoods in America disappearing at an alarming rate. So that is a major issue, and I could see where that would be a major problem. So the federal government's in charge, you know, in your vision of how this works, the federal government is in charge of all of this?
The federal government is the perpetrator, and so the federal government has responsibility for making things right.
And how about if you earmark a portion of the funds to giving people a step up? So in terms of education or job training or learning a craft or a trade or something that empowers them, not just financially.
I think you give the funds to individuals and let them make the decision about how to use it. If they want to use it for that purpose, fine. There is a myth that we tend to embrace that education and training will solve all of our problems. But in fact, if we look at the racial wealth gap, we have a situation in which black heads of households who have a college degree have only 2/3 of the net worth of white heads of households who never finished high school. So educational attainment is not something that's going to close the racial wealth gap.
Wow.
So we need to do something far more potent. Yeah.
My gosh.
Well, the only thing that I have to, the only comment I have to make in connection to what Maria said is, what about the environment, Dr. Doherty, that Richard Nixon proposed a thing called the Family Assistance Plan, which was direct payments to people on welfare. He wanted to disband the welfare system and come up with a thing that we generally refer to as a negative income tax. I know you're an economist, so you know about this. He and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a senator at the time, worked hard to get this legislation passed, and it couldn't happen. Has the environment changed enough, do you think, over the years, that we could have that kind of system, that we could get something like that appropriated through Congress?
So I think that is actually very similar to Andrew Yang's proposal for a universal basic income, except it's executed through the tax structure rather than just giving people a direct subsidy. Right. The problem is, of course, I'm concerned about the racial wealth gap, not the racial income gap per se. And programs like the negative income tax or the Andrew Yang universal basic income are income supplements. But the magnitude of the difference in incomes is completely dwarfed by the magnitude of the differences in wealth. And by wealth, I mean the difference between the value of what you own and the value of what you owe. So it's the net value of your property. And this provides you with a store of resources that are available in times of emergencies, that permits you to have a greater opportunity to purchase a quality home in a quality neighborhood. So this is very different from income. And so programs that would increase people's incomes are desirable from my standpoint, but it doesn't get at the core issue of this gulf in wealth between blacks and whites in the United States.
And what about, if, for example, you put in a housing program, let's talk about this for a second. Let's say you gave African-Americans who wanted to buy, and some cities do this. I think we do this in Washington to a certain extent, very limited extent. But you want to buy your first home. We gave them a mortgage assistant, down payment assistant, whatever that would be, a home actually being the primary asset of most older Americans to close that wealth gap. Wouldn't that be in the self-interest of getting, I'm thinking practically as a politician, of getting this thing passed, because then you would have the realtors on your side and you would have the home builders on your side and all the people that would benefit from directing the money into a particular asset like that. What do you think about that? What's the downside of that?
I'm not opposed to that. I think there's, both Elizabeth Warren and I believe Kamala Harris have proposed something along those lines. I think their idea is to try to get the black home ownership rate to be comparable to the white home ownership rate. So move the black home ownership rate from, say, 45 to 46% up to closer to 74 or 75%. And I don't think this is a bad idea, but I don't think it would actually make sufficient headway towards eliminating the racial wealth gap. And that's in part because a project of that sort is one in which you do not equalize equity in the homes. You only increase the home ownership rate if it's effective enough to do that. I mean, if you're talking about cities like Los Angeles, California, where the median priced home is $600,000 to $700,000, the modest kinds of down payment supplements that we're typically talking about, particularly in the Warren and Harris kinds of proposals, aren't really going to let people buy into the average priced house or the typically priced house in their city. So I don't think this is a bad idea, but I think it has limitations.
Well, you know, the thing that I guess I don't get is that our affordable housing program here in the Maryland suburbs in Montgomery County are to take market-priced homes and reduce their price to certain qualified buyers. Now, doesn't that automatically – I mean, if you buy a $300,000 house and they sell it to you for $250,000, you already have $50,000 equity, do you not?
Yeah, but if it's a universal program, then – do you truly believe that it will disproportionately benefit blacks enough to close the racial wealth gap?
I don't know. I just feel that, you know, especially in the horrible environment that we have right now, where racism has once again raised its ugly head, I just am trying to think of practical ways to make this happen. And I really have a hard time.
So my thinking is, for us to have any reasonable opportunity to make any bold, transformative changes in the United States, whether it's via universal programs or it's a program that's targeted at black Americans as a consequence of the racial wealth gap, we will have to have a change in the character of the Congress. I would not have any expectation of any important or significant program actually being adopted under the current configuration of Congress with somebody like Mitch McConnell serving as the majority leader. So Congress has to be changed. Then we can talk about really adopting these kinds of programs.
That puts you and me in the same boat because that's where we stand. That's where we stand on D.C. statehood as well. I'm sorry, Maria, I don't mean to monopolize things. Go ahead.
Thank you, because I want to bring up where my training comes in clinical psychology, Dr. Darity, because of the transgenerational trauma and actually the diagnosis of post-traumatic slave syndrome. Is there a portion of the proceeds that could go to mental health counseling or some sort of mental health approach whereby the tragedy doesn't keep going, the trauma, through more and more of our offspring?
So this is a sensitive issue. And again, I kind of revert to the view that if we increase the resources that individual families have, they can make the decision about what's most needed for them. If they want to purchase therapeutic services, they can do so. But I say this is a sensitive issue because I'm not entirely convinced by the post-slavery syndrome argument. I think that black folks in their day-to-day experiences, their lived experiences in the current moment, are subjected to such a significant amount of trauma that we don't have to revert to some notion that these traumatic psychological impacts are something that are transmitted across generations. And in fact, the argument that it's transmitted across generations is consistent with the view that there's something damaged about black people. I don't think that there's anything damaged about black people. What black people are confronted with is a damaged set of conditions, and we need to change those conditions. I'm not so much worried about changing black people.
Well, and I'm curious, though, pardon me, Michael, culturally, different communities react to mental health care or diagnoses or even seeking therapy or counseling. Can you speak about what the black community, how they view that? There are other cultures that view it as they're wounded.
I can't speak for, you know, all black Americans about what their attitudes are towards therapy or counseling. It is my impression, though, that black Americans do receive therapeutic services, but they are therapeutic services that frequently are not necessarily from psychiatric or psychiatric workers or psychologists. Some of their therapeutic services come from ministers in the context of being in a part of a church community. So, you know, there may be an issue about whether or not you call it therapy, but there certainly is not, to the best of my knowledge, an intrinsic aversion to that kind of counseling or support. I think it's a question of who is providing it. And I think people would turn more towards professional counselors if they had the resources to purchase those services.
Well, you know, in regards to this whole conversation here with what Maria has brought up, again, Marianne Williamson said to us on the show that she believes that reparations are essential for America to start healing the racial divide, that they are essential for the country to come to grips with what has happened in the past and reconcile it and move forward. And in that light, I see exactly the point that Marie is trying to make. One of my, I remember many, many years ago going to a lecture by Dick Gregory, and he said that America's always had a whipping boy. In blacks were for very long time the whipping boy for America, and he told us, this was back in the 60s, he told us that young people were the new whipping boy in those days. So how do we get America on the right psychological track? I hate to keep on beating this, you know, it's not a dead horse, but I hate to keep on harping on this, but how do we make this palatable to America?
Well, I think Maria Sanchez probably knows more about this because she's engaged in thinking about political communication. But I will say this. I think a reason why we have a significant degree of reluctance to address these kinds of issues is associated with the way in which we have taught our American community about the Civil War, Reconstruction, and race relations in the United States. And much of the teaching that we have done in the schools in particular, but also through media sources like the movies, much of the teaching that we've done has crafted a false story about the Civil War and Reconstruction, and it's been shaped to a large degree by the activities of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And so I think we need to confront the way in which we think about the memory of the nation's history as a starting point for trying to alter the way in which people view what the nation should be doing.
Well, you know, that makes my point exactly, too. I think that statement is very, very important because, you know, I've grown up in my entire life from the time I was a child until now. I've grown up in communities, urban communities, that are predominantly black. But when I go visit my family down in Alabama and I see black people in Alabama, they act a lot differently than the black people in Washington, D.C. or Newark, New Jersey, which is my hometown. I mean, there's a different, I've noticed it right away, and I was just amazed that they quickly, blacks that I've run into in the South in service positions and other things seem to quickly fall right into a subordinate role when they're dealing with me as a white guy. So I think that, you know, obviously what you just said is very, very true in the South. But how do we change that narrative? Does it require us to revamp the way we teach American history?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely. But I was wondering a bit about your comment about differences in behavior in North and South. I think that there's an even more dense history of white terrorism in the South.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that may lead to black folks there having a different degree of caution. But, you know, it certainly was activism largely by Southern whites that led to the civil rights movement and its successes. So it's a very difficult thing to determine whether people are putting on a front for safety purposes or whether they really do have those kinds of deferential attitudes. So I think we have to be careful in terms of how we interpret what we observe. But although there were white massacres across the United States, including northern cities like Detroit and Chicago, a disproportionate amount of white terror took place in the South. And so I think that might account for some of the things that you're observing.
Well, you know, I really don't sense, just to add to this for a second, that there's any fear associated with me. I just get the sense that black people in the South, in my experience, were much more willing to allow me to be in control, like of the conversation or whatever. When I was in college, I did an experiment where I was involved, where they would send us into groups of colleges, you know, other co-eds that were, in the same position we were, but there'd be a group of women, and men very often took over the conversation as soon as they got involved. Women backed up and allowed men to lead. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. I get a sense of that in the South. But I'm sure you're right. I mean, it's a different environment and different circumstances that have molded their opinions. Maria?
Yes, I'd like to ask, in a perfect world, which I know we're far from, how would you see this proceeding? How would it unfold? What would happen? What needs to the senator's question about, you know, what can we do? Well, how would it work if it was going to work? If we all came to a consensus that, yes, this is the moral thing to do, this is the ethical thing to do, this is how we're going to heal, this is how we're going to get closure, let's let it unfold. What does that look like?
Well, now, are you talking about doing this independently of having some preliminary commission that would design the exact details of such a program?
Well, I guess if you had your wish list, what would you do? How would you handle it?
Right, head of the commission.
Yeah, what does it look like? I'm trying to get an idea of the logistics and the time frame and the funding and the unfolding.
So I have some thoughts about the funding. I have some thoughts about the unfolding. I'm somewhat constrained because Kirsten Mullen and I have a new book that will be coming out in February 2020 that's called From Here to Equality. And it is a book that will include a chapter that offers a detailed description of how one might actually execute a reparations program.
Okay.
And if I reveal that tonight, my publisher will be extremely upset.
Okay, we're gonna book you for February.
When you do your book tour.
but I can say this: there are two ways in which I've given some thought to the question of how much the bill should be. One way is to think about, and this is very much of a lower bound estimate. This is not the total. But one approach is to think about what the present value would be of the 40-acre land grant. So if that would have amounted to, say, 40 million acres of land distributed to the 4 million formerly enslaved, then we can come up with an estimate that land would probably have a value today in the vicinity of $1.5 to $2 trillion. But I already mentioned that I think what the central goal should be, the central economic goal of a reparations program, is eliminating the racial wealth gap. And I've said that would take $10 to $12 trillion. So there's a number of ways of thinking about calculating that, but those are a couple that I think should be taken seriously.
Have you looked at, when I ran my own political consulting firm, I worked with a congressman from California named Bob Matsui, who was able to secure, after many, many years and a lot of work in Congress, reparations for the survivors of internment camps during the Second World War. I mean, I think most of our listeners know that Japanese Americans were put into internment camps. I don't know what they called them, but basically they were camps to keep them isolated during the Second World War. Matsui was able to get reparations for all those people. Have you looked at what he did in Congress?
Yeah, we've looked at that. Kirsten Mullins looked at it in much greater detail than I have. But that's an important template for how we might proceed with the reparations program for Black Americans. In fact, interestingly enough, the prelude to Japanese American reparations for their unjust incarceration during World War II was the formation of a commission called the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. And that commission had two major responsibilities. The first was to set the historical record straight, and an important aspect of that was demonstrating that the U.S. officialdom knew that Japanese Americans were not a threat to the nation's security, but they still proceeded to incarcerate them. And so that's one facet of that report that was critical. The other facet of the report was the actual design of a restitution program. And so I think similarly, one might have, as a prelude to the full execution of a reparations program, is a commission that would set the historical record straight on racial injustice in the United States and also provide a detailed program of restitution.
Let me ask you to do me a favor, Dr. Darity. I am going to be a speaker next Sunday at a wreath-laying ceremony for the 400th anniversary of the docking of the first slave ships in Georgetown. We're going to lay a wreath. The National Park Service has put together a program where there'll be a wreath-laying on the waterfront where the ships used to dock. When I give my speech, if you could give me one thing that you would want me to say in that speech, what would that be?
Wow. Let me think about the connection. Where is this going to happen again?
It's going to happen on the waterfront in Georgetown at what is presumably, there's a plaque there that recognizes the first slave ships that came into the District of Columbia, what is now the District of Columbia. But in those days, Georgetown was the original slave market, evidently, in the District of Columbia. So it's there, and it's the 400th anniversary of the first slave ships to come to America, or at least to come to the District of Columbia.
Well, you know, I think that there could be a connection that could be drawn to the attention that we are now giving to Georgetown University's relationship with slavery. And the fact that I guess the Jesuits were at one point the fourth largest slaveholders in the United States. So, you know, we can think about 1619 as we wouldn't necessarily have known in 1619 how things would have unfolded, but the initial act of importing people to be sold into slavery resulted in something far, far more horrifying and atrocious. And I think that the Georgetown University story is intimately connected to that historical record.
And, you know, just since you brought up Georgetown, I should point out that the students at Georgetown have made overtures to having the college resolve somehow, take responsibility. The college has, in fact, taken responsibility for their role, and are now, I think, trying to work out ways that they can redress what they've done, what had been done in the past. So we'll see how that pans out. And God bless those students who stood up and demanded action. It's great to see young people get involved like that. Maria, before we let our guests go, because we're running out of time,
yes,
you got anything else?
Well, Dr. Darity, I don't know. I know this pales in comparison to what you're attempting to do for us, and I want to thank you for all that you've done and the wisdom that you're providing and the guidance and the counsel, and I'm looking forward to reading your book next February. But just over a couple weeks ago, there was an agreement between the University of the West Indies and the University of Glasgow, and they signed some slavery reparations bill that's going to go into funding an educational community to teach, and I don't know what you think about that. Do you think that's significant, or are they just giving lip service?
I don't really know. I do know Sir Hilary Beckles, who is the head of the CARICOM Commission on Reparations, and he seems to think that this is something that would be very valuable for them. And I'm not in a position to judge whether or not, you know, he's correct or he's incorrect on that. I mean, he's much closer to the situation on the ground there.
Yeah.
But I don't think an educational program would be sufficient in the United States, although I think an important facet of a reparations program must be an educational program that addresses our historical memory of racism in the United States.
And I think that's a great point, because I know the senator asked you something about that, about our education, and they're calling theirs a slavery-enriched institution, and really to get history correct and not to have it be folklore or verbal, you know, transmission over the years where we forget really what happened.
Yeah, I think that's vital.
And before we let you go, Doctor, can you tell us what haven't we asked you? Is there anything else you want to say about this? Is there any place where people can get more information? Do you have a website or something? Or is there something else you want to add to the conversation, please?
I think that the major thing I want to add is that frequently people refer to black reparations as slavery reparations. And while slavery was the crucible that created this long trajectory of injustice, we have to keep on the tab or on the account many, many things that took place after slavery ended, including the denial of the formerly enslaved of the 40 acres, including the range of upwards of 40 white massacres that destroyed black property, resulted in the appropriation of black land, and took black lives. We have to take into account various policies in the 20th century that restricted black home ownership, ranging from restrictive covenants to redlining to the discriminatory application of the GI Bill. And we have to keep in mind that we now are faced with a crisis of mass incarceration, police killings of unarmed blacks, and sustained employment discrimination. And so when I talk about the case for reparations, the case is not solely about slavery. It is about the entire trajectory of injustice in the United States.
Well, thank you for that
distinction, actually. Yes.
And thanks for being on the show. We hope you'll come back when your book comes out so that we can talk about that.
Would you mind repeating the title again, please?
Yeah. Not at all. It's called From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century.
If that doesn't say it all, very nice.
Well, we hope to talk to you again in February.
Let me add, it's going to be published by the University of North Carolina Press.
Great.
Well, I would just say, we'll be seeing you again in March Madness, maybe not this year, but some year. So fear the turtle, Doctor, and thank you so much for being on the show. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you
for having me. Thanks. Uh-huh.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I want to end tonight with two things. First of all, this weekend is the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. One of my great regrets in life is that somebody told me about it and I didn't pay any attention, and my friend went and I did not. But, you know, I'd love to see us get back to a position in America where we have events like this. You know, it was a weekend of peace, love, and music. That's how it was portrayed or the PR around it. But what it did actually was it represented an entire generation, and it changed the way we looked at things. The Vietnam War, social injustice, it really, really changed America and brought us all together. I don't know, my brilliant co-host might have a better idea on how to bring America together, but I wish we could find something that would bring us back together in kind of the loving way that Woodstock did.
Yeah, but how about the fact that Woodstock 50 didn't really happen, that the anniversary really didn't go?
I know, we need something else. It was transmitted here to Maryland, to the Meriwether Post Pavilion, where we much smaller venue where I've been many times, and then they canceled it because they couldn't get enough right. So you know what I think it says is that baby boomers don't always have the greatest ideas anymore, or that maybe we've just become complacent.
Well, and acts kept canceling, and so you know at some one point there was nothing. Right. You know, unlike Coachella and Burning Man and all the other things that keep thriving. So I don't know what it says, actually. It's kind of sad, but I'm glad it meant something to you.
Well, it did, and the world has changed, you know. I didn't see the Who at Woodstock, but I went to see him a year ago in a lounge. And I mean, a big lounge, an auditorium of maybe several thousand people, but not 400,000 people anymore.
Right. Right.
So the business of it has changed, too.
But and briefly, can you talk? Okay, I know you want to speak about Peter Fonda, and may he rest in peace. His obituary was just fascinating to read, but why don't you share what your relationship?
Well, I just want to say that at 16 years old, I was lost. Both my parents had died. I had the biggest chip on my shoulder. I thought that everybody in the world was against me. I was really, really in a bad place. And I went to a movie theater and I saw Easy Rider. I bought a Harley Davidson from a neighbor. I started riding mostly because I couldn't get car insurance because I was an orphan and I was a minor who was on his own. I started driving motorcycles, but I got a Harley, and Peter Fonda inspired me to go across America. A few years later, I went to all 48 states. not on my Harley because it broke down every 3 miles in those days. I'd be still in Maryland trying to get out. But I did. But it did inspire me to see America. I found a whole new world out there. I found people that were loving and receptive. I came back to after that trip as a high school dropout, got into college, stayed there until I got a master's degree, and changed my life. And in some ways, it started with watching a movie which encouraged me to seek a new life and a new way and freedom. And, you know, I'm 66 years old, and I still drive a Harley occasionally. So God bless you, Peter Fonda. You had a great impact on my life, even though you didn't know it.
But what a great story about how poignant and powerful art is. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Because
some people could say, well, it was just entertainment, you know, and Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson and whatever. But you just have proven the point why art is so important for us as a culture and as a society. Look, it changed your life.
Right. Just like music, it touches us at a level that's deeper than, you know, what you and I do every weekend, this conversation, it touches us at a much deeper level.
Speaking of music, I got to see Hamilton when I was in Chicago.
Was it great or what?
Oh, my gosh. And I bought the soundtrack and listened, I think, 4 full times before I saw it. And I can't stop listening to it. And now I'm singing the songs in my head. Oh, my goodness. That man is brilliant. First of all, Alexander Hamilton, but Lin-Manuel. It's Quiet Uptown, I think, is my most favorite one because of it's so poignant about he and Eliza after the death of their son and what they do and that they move uptown and they actually reconcile and there's forgiveness. I mean, it makes me cry every time I listen to it.
Mine is King George's song.
Oh, my gosh. She was interviewed by Terry Crews this week.
Yeah. Was that right?
Yeah, it was fabulous. You got to look it up. It wasn't the original Broadway guy. It was the next iteration where he made, as she said, you made King George somewhat Queen George. And yeah. He said, I was channeling my inner Barbara Streisand.
Well, you know, it's just so perfect because it's so myopic. And
yes.
It's so self-centered.
Yes.
And it so expresses what politicians are very often, unfortunately.
Yes.
Well, we're going to leave you tonight with a song from the movie
Of Easy Rider. But 2 quick questions. When do you go to India and when is the hearing for
Stanley? I go to India on the 27th of this month.
Okay.
So we'll be on the air next weekend with A. Scott Bolden, CNN pundit and Washington lawyer. And then I go the Tuesday after that, so a week from Tuesday. And of course, if my visa comes through, I can't tell you the process to get an Indian visa.
Obviously it's changed because I went there about 7 or 8 years ago. I applied on Monday, sent it to San Francisco, and I had it on that Friday.
Well, the website just confounded me, and they only do it on the website now. So hopefully I'm going to get it, or I'm going to have to go sit at the embassy towards the end of the week and beg to get and straighten it out.
Okay.
Hearing is on the 18th of September.
Okay. And you'll be back.
Yeah, and we're all gearing up for that. So we leave you tonight with The Byrds, Wasn't Born to Follow, because thank you, Peter Fonda. You inspired in me an attitude that I wasn't born to follow. Thanks.
I'd rather go and journey where the diamond crescent's glowing and run across the valley beneath the sacred mountain and wander through the forest where the trees
representation in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation give the people their right to vote.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.